Should we keep her on nasal cannula, or should we move to a non-invasive ventilation therapy or high flow?
The one caution I would say is that I think we're almost tending to overuse it.
High flow may reduce the intubation rate, or it may make patients feel better, but it's not changing mortality. Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. So happy you're joining us for this podcast. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland, and really excited to have this discussion with my stellar co-host on CCPEM regarding a very common treatment that we do universally, I would say, almost in every critically ill patient, and that is the administration of oxygen. So what I'd ask all of you to think about as we're getting into this podcast is a case. And this was a case that came into our emergency department a few months ago. This was a 46-year-old female who essentially was brought to us by Baltimore City paramedic with vomiting, near syncope, and hypoxemia. She had had URI-type symptoms over the preceding days, had developed a worsening cough that eventually became productive, which she had seen her primary care physician 48 hours earlier, and she'd gotten some scripts for medications, which she just felt too bad, couldn't get filled. However, on the day of presentation, she made it to the pharmacy, got her meds, and as she walked out, she was witnessed by bystanders to have a syncopal event. EMS was called, they arrived, and essentially found the patient quite tachypneic, breathing at a true 25 to 27 breaths per minute and satting just 83% on room air. So they put her on supplemental O2, bring her into the ED where she remains in moderate distress. She's working a little bit to breathe, no overt accessory muscle use, but a true tachypnea. That hypoxemia had improved. She was about 91%, 92%, and she was receiving 4 liters of O2 via nasal cannula at that time. No preceding pulmonary history on lung exam, some diffuse and scattered bronchi. But as we talk about many things that we were doing to evaluate and care for her, the question became, how should we deliver supplemental O2? Should we keep her on nasal cannula, or should we move to other, say, non-invasive ventilation therapy or high-flow nasal cannula that we are using more and more? So I'd ask all of you, what would you do in this particular case? So with that, let's pause. We're going to get back to this case, this discussion, and layer in a hot-off-the-press article that looks at what that question raises in her case, and we'll get to that momentarily. But need to introduce my amazing co-host, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, really excited for this discussion. Peter, I'm going to start with you. And it was so great to see you recently on the University of Maryland campus for the Maryland chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians annual educational conference. You were one of our keynote speakers talking about mechanical ventilation. Great to see you in Baltimore. How were travels home? And how does this podcast find you?
What a great treat to be in Baltimore to participate in Maryland ASAP. It was great engaging learners, practicing physicians. So that was great fun. And then got quick turnaround to return home for Jazz Fest, which was spectacular. Whether we were seeing David Byrne, Teddy Swims, Tedeschi Trucks, Earth, Wind & Fire. It's a pretty profound lineup. So it's been a good time.
Outstanding. Well, as I've mentioned in prior podcasts, there is always some festival going on in New Orleans. So it's that time again for Jazz Fest. Well, let me jump from New Orleans out west to California. Dr. Rodriguez, you've got some great celebrations going on in the family. Tell us about those.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. My son is graduating from Haverford in 10 days. And my daughter is graduating from Stanford Law in a month. So yeah, I'm looking forward to celebrating with them and seeing where they go from there.
Well, huge congratulations to them on a tremendous amount of work and success, and congrats to you as well, Rob. Dr. Greenwood, we had talked before about some graduations, key messages, updates you'd like to lead into as we start off this podcast.
Well, I couldn't think of a better segue to congratulate Rob and his family, as well as all of the residents and trainees, those who have matched and are about to get make their way to their residency programs and start as interns in the emergency department, rotate through the ICU, or those who are graduating residency and about to practice on their own. Now, it's important for all of you to know you are never alone. There is always someone who you can call, but certainly, please take us with you. We love hearing from all the trainees, and please continue to stay in contact. Listen to us from time to time. We hope to continue giving you clinical pearls that you can use on your shift. And most importantly, wish you good luck.
So well said, John. And I think that you speak for all of us with respect to keeping in touch. Best of luck. And we're going to continue to keep you updated with respect to critical topics for the resuscitation of our patients that we see every day. So let's bounce back now to that case, the 46-year-old female presenting with essentially acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. We've got some work to do in terms of figuring out the etiology. Why is she so hypoxemic? But we don't want to let her sit there with 80-some percent saturations on room air. We're providing her with some supplemental O2 via nasal cannula. But the question becomes, should we escalate that perhaps from standard nasal cannula to high flow, maybe even to non-invasive ventilation? Or should we even think about mechanical ventilation? And I think we'll pause on going to that extreme. But let's just talk about an emerging therapy that I would suspect many of us are familiar with, we're using and with increasing frequency, and that is high flow oxygen therapy. And the reason we want to talk about it is because there's a recent article just published in the New England Journal of Medicine titled High Flow or Standard Oxygen in Acute Hypoxemic Respiratory Failure. So we're going to unpack this study. And then at the end, what are the clinical implications of this particular study on how we're treating patients who come into our EDs, who are in our ICUs with hypoxemic respiratory failure? So with that, Dr. Rodriguez, take it away, set the stage, give us the background as we lead into this particular New England Journal of Medicine study.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So a little bit of background is that acute respiratory failure is the leading cause of admission to ICUs across the US and across the globe. Acute hypoxemic respiratory failure in the absence of cardiogenic pulmonary edema or chronic respiratory diseases is primarily caused by viral or bacterial pneumonia. And as everybody knows, oxygen is the first-line therapy for acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. And it can be delivered in a number of ways by standard nasal cannula, by non-rebreather mask, through high flow through a nasal cannula, or with non-invasive ventilation. And we have to remember that the primary goals of managing acute hypoxemic respiratory failure are to, one, improve outcomes, two, to avoid further lung injury, and three, notably, to avoid intubation, because intubation is it itself is associated with worse outcomes and potential for lung injury. So standard oxygen via nasal cannula or non-rebreather, those techniques of delivery are thought to be limited in their ability to provide high levels of FiO2 and also limited in their ability to unload the respiratory muscles. In contrast, high flow oxygen and non-invasive ventilation improve oxygenation and relieve patient effort and dyspnea. So current guidelines recommend the use of high flow oxygen rather than non-invasive ventilation or standard oxygen as first line treatment for acute hypoxemic respiratory failure to reduce risk of intubation, although the results on mortality have been less consistent. So, to address the lack of evidence on whether high flow is superior to standard oxygen in reducing mortality, these authors conducted the SOHO trial, the high flow or standard oxygen in acute hypoxemic respiratory failure trial in New England Journal of Medicine this year.
Thanks so much, Rob. Really great establishing the foundation. And I'm glad that you mentioned the name of the trial. I didn't upfront. So when we talk about this trial, everyone's going to hear of it as referred to as the Soho trial. So, Dr. W, pivoting now to you, what were the objectives? What were the methods so we really understand what they were studying here in this particular trial?
So just to bring us back to the initial case we started with, this initial case is perfect for this study. And so the objective is to compare two oxygen strategies, either high flow versus standard oxygen therapy, in patients who are admitted to an ICU for acute hypoxemic respiratory failure, much like the patient we opened with. So the methods, it's an investigator-initiated, open-label, randomized control trial. It involved 42 different ICUs in France. The patients that were included, these were adults. They had to be 18 or older to be enrolled, admitted to the ICU with a diagnosis of acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. Their respiratory rate had to be greater than 25 breaths per minute. They had to have pulmonary infiltrates on chest X-ray. The PDF ratio of 200 or less while breathing oxygen at 10 liters per minute through a non-rebreather mask. So these were sick patients. No one could argue whether or not they were, in fact, having hypoxic respiratory failure to be included. Now, who was excluded? Those who had an elevated PaCO2 greater than 45. So hoping to get the chronic CO2 retainers out of the picture. Those patients who were deemed to be in a COPD exacerbation, those with chronic lung disease, with long-term oxygen therapy prescribed to them, so home O2. Those patients who look to be in congestive heart failure, so having cardiogenic pulmonary edema, and those who were hemodynamically unstable, those with altered mental status, those who met criteria for emergent intubation, and those who had a code status of DNR. Now, randomization, we looked within the first 3 hours of meeting the inclusion criteria, those were enrolled 1-to-1 to high flow group versus standard oxygen therapy group. The high flow group received a flow rate of at least 50 liters per minute. FI2 was adjusted to maintain SATs 92% to 96%. They received this for at least 48 hours. And after 48 hours, could be stopped and switched to standard oxygen if the respiratory rate was less than 25 breaths per minute and the SATs of at least 92% with an FiO2 of 40% or less. Standard oxygen was delivered through a non-rebreather with oxygen set at 10 liters per minute or more. It was adjusted to maintain their saturations 92% to 96%. When we look at their primary outcomes, 28-day all-cause mortality, the secondary outcomes, endotracheal intubation at day 28, interval between randomization and intubation, their ventilator-free days, ICU mortality, in-hospital mortality, and 90-day mortality, and then ICU and hospital length of stay. To ensure consistency of intubation, investigators developed specified criteria. Again, severe respiratory failure, respiratory rate greater than 40 breaths per minute, respiratory muscle fatigue, a pH of less than 7.35, a PDF ratio of less than 100 despite 15 liters per minute, and an FiO2 of 80% or more. Recurrent episodes of SATs less than 80%, SATs less than 88% with maximum oxygen support, those who had cardiac arrest, those with hemodynamic instability, and those with deteriorating neurological status. Again, the statistical analysis calculated sample size of our 1,110 patients to provide 80% to show an absolute difference of 6 percentage points in 28-day mortality.
Thanks so much, Peter. Really helpful to understand this particular SOHO trial. Very applicable patients, as you led off, included in this study, the randomization to high flow standard O2. And then I really like how they put together criteria objectively to say when patients needed to get or should be intubated rather than leaving it to the clinician and then introducing some variability in clinical practice. So outstanding job there. Now, Dr. Greenwood, so on to you to tell us what were the results of the SOHO trial? Was there or is there a difference in that mortality, high flow versus standard O2?
All right. So, yeah, this was a really large randomized control trial. In fact, a total of a little over 1,100 patients were included in the intention to treat analysis, and they were equally divided, about 550 patients in the high flow group and the standard group. And honestly, this was a randomized control trial. So, as you would expect, it was pretty well balanced in terms of demographics between each group. But there was a slightly higher percentage of men and higher median dyspnea score, as well as a lower respiratory rate in the high flow group compared to the standard group. Now, pneumonia was the leading cause of respiratory failure in this patient population, and 53% of those patients with pneumonia were categorized in the viral category, and a third of those were COVID-19 patients. So, as we all remember, high flow nasal cannula really became a high impact therapy in that viral pneumonia group. And so this is a very relevant patient population to patients we see in the emergency department and ICU. The interventions, as described, were either high flow nasal cannula, which was initiated at about 50 liters a minute, and the average FiO2 concentration was just under 70%. And that was compared to the standard group, which had an initial flow rate of around 12 liters a minute. Both high flow and standard oxygen were delivered for a median of 4 days of therapy, and 37 patients received non-invasive positive pressure ventilation as a rescue therapy. So, if we take a look at the primary outcome, and remember, this trial was designed to detect a 6% difference in mortality. What they found was that the 28-day mortality in the high flow nasal cannula group was almost 15%. And when you compare that to the standard group, well, it was exactly the same. So no difference in the primary outcome. And when they looked at the secondary outcomes, particularly the incidence of intubation by 28 days, they found a slight trend towards a higher rate of intubation in the standard oxygen group of about 48% compared to 42%. Now, this did have a very wide confidence interval that was between minus 0.08 and minus almost 12. So, this is a pretty large confidence interval. And in terms of the ability to impact symptoms, as well as some of the other secondary variables, high flow nasal cannula appeared to improve respiratory rate, carbon dioxide retention, and subjective dyspnea scores. So the patients may have felt better with the use of high flow nasal cannula. Next, looked at safety outcomes, particularly the incidence of pneumothorax, which in total there were 10 pneumothoraces in the high flow nasal cannula group compared to four in the standard group. And there was really no difference in cardiac arrest. Three patients in high flow, two patients in standard therapy.
All right, so we have the results of the SOHO trial, and their primary outcome was no different. No difference in 28-day mortality between those in the high flow group versus those in the standard group. Now, as many of you longtime listeners know, we like to just touch on a few limitations that the authors brought out in their paper. And they do state that overall, they actually had a lower mortality rate, so that 15% than what they expected. They hypothesized or postulated that because of the degree and percentage of, say, COVID patients with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure, there was a pretty high use of corticosteroids. And so did that in some way lower the overall mortality? And as a result of lowering the mortality, was their overall statistical analysis underpowered at the end of the day with their 1,100 plus patients? And then they also draw out that this was a high percentage of patients who, in fact, had a viral pneumonia in contrast to bacterial pneumonia. And Peter went through all of the exclusionary conditions that weren't enrolled in this study. But gentlemen, let's kind of turn it now to our discussion. Peter, I'm going to start with you. If I read the one-liner, if I read the abstract, is it fair for me to walk away and say, look, high flow doesn't actually improve mortality? I could still go with a non-rebreather, perhaps nasal cannula for these patients with acute hypoxemic failure. High flow may reduce the intubation rate, or it may make patients feel better, but it's not changing mortality. So should I really start to lessen my utilization of this?
Yeah, I will tell you this. If you asked me that question 2 years ago, I wasn't such a big fan of humidified high flow nasal cannula other than bridging to intubation and from intubation in COVID patients. I thought that maybe the manufacturers were looking to apply it to everybody and anybody that came in the ED. I'm now looking at the literature that is compiled. The signal is pretty strong for relieving dyspnea scores, right? People feeling more comfortable with humidified high flow nasal cannula, not all, but on the main, more comfortable than with BiPAP. And initially, we said we're going to steer away from this because, really, for our COPD patients and CO2 retainers, this is a no-no. We should just go with BiPAP. And the data is, again, beginning to signal that you can have some ease of fatigue in those patients with COPD and CO2 retention. So I'm a bigger fan for it. I think if you're going to see larger studies, you're going to see more reduction in intubation. And again, with those intubations, there's risk associated with that. There's risk with RSI in this sick patient population, and then complications of intubation and mechanical ventilation. And I think eventually you're going to see mortality numbers really differentiate themselves when they start pooling more studies together.
Really insightful thoughts, Peter. Thank you. And let me jump now over to Rob for his analysis of this SOHO trial.
Yeah, I didn't really like this study. I really didn't expect there to be an outcome difference, and that's not really what, in my view, high flow is intended to do. It's intended to do like what Peter and John said, which is to, try and avert intubation, to try and relieve patient comfort. And there's nothing in this study that says it doesn't do that. In fact, there is a bit of a signal that it does improve comfort and avert intubation. So not a big fan of this study. I'm right where Peter is, I believe, in that I've increased my use of high flow. But the one caution I would say is that I think we're almost tending to overuse it now. Like anytime anybody's pushing, getting into requiring higher nasal cannula support, people are jumping straight to high flow. And I think from a resource utilization standpoint, we should also be cautious in that regard. So, yeah, didn't really like this study. I'm increasing my fandom of high flow, but would caution against overuse.
All right, Dr. Rodriguez telling us how he really feels about this particular study. Over to Dr. Greenwood. John, what say you?
So, as many people are aware, I'm not a huge fan of mortality as an outcome in many of these critical care trials. They almost got there. This secondary outcome of looking at the incidence of intubation between the two probably was the outcome I was interested in most for all the reasons that Rob and Peter suggested, that you can provide humidified oxygen, it's practical, it only goes over the nose, patients tolerate it a lot better. You can, if they're coughing excessively, they don't have a full face mask on. There's a lot of practical reasons that high flow nasal cannula likely has an impact on intubation rates. And so, if I had one wish for this trial, that would have been that they powered it to detect a difference in intubation, not necessarily mortality. And then all the secondary outcomes could be why that might have been. And that could have helped me understand which patients might better select utilizing high flow rather than moving right on to mechanical ventilation or choosing a standard mask versus resource utilizing my high flow for a different patient. That would be my one wish. And maybe if someone's out there, Brian Fuller, any of the respiratory failure guys in the United States looking for a siren trial, that would be a great idea and maybe something we could do on a multi-center trial.
Gentlemen, I'm so thankful this is such a very helpful podcast. Wanted to get any final thoughts before we bring this podcast to a close.
Yeah, I have a few that, I kind of like the practical wisdom piece. Like, what are you going to give people to walk away from the podcast with? And this is less practical wisdom, like, what are you going to do differently? But what's left out there? We still don't know a whole heck of a lot of evidence and science on the weaning aspects of humidified high flow nasal cannula. Are we going to wean the flow? We're going to wean the FiO2. And then this issue about if I've got humidified high flow nasal cannula, am I a candidate for the floor or do I need to go to the ICU? And again, much like I use non-invasive BiPAP, if I'm titrating up and this is new for you, you're going to the ICU. But I would love to hear what John has to say in regards to his practice and Rob as well.
Yeah, this is a really tough question, Peter, because you're right. I'm not aware of any high quality or even medium quality evidence to guide clinicians on how to titrate up or down your high flow nasal cannula. My general practice, and this is strictly based on experience during rounds and in between rounds, is that I find the flow piece of high flow nasal cannula to be more helpful with work of breathing than necessarily the FiO2. And anyone who's on high flow nasal cannula or high concentration oxygen from standard oxygen therapy, the work of breathing is so important because that really tells me if the patient is improving or are they sliding backwards a little bit too much as I de-escalate, or do I need to start coming up with a plan B or C? So I tend to decrease the FiO2, and as long as the saturations stay okay, I'm in a good spot. But if the work of breathing changes, I might have to go back up. But if they're okay and sats are okay, I'll start titrating down the flow next and really pay attention to the respiratory rate.
Yeah, what you're saying makes complete physiologic sense. I like that approach, John. The flow is analogous to the pressure in at non-invasive ventilation, and you titrate pressure in non-invasive ventilation according to work of breathing, and you titrate your FiO2 according to oxygenation. So I really like that. I also agree about what Peter said about triaging patients. Although I do think that patients who are on a stable high flow, let's say they're not on max high flow, they can be managed in a non-full ICU setting and maybe like a step down setting.
Do you guys have, just out of curiosity, a kind of a limit? Like, I know at University of Pennsylvania, we have like a 60-60 rule. If they're above 60%, 60 liters, they're coming to the ICU, or we can admit them to the pulmonary floor is kind of another nice little trigger for us. I don't know if you guys have any other local isms.
We have standard cutoffs, but I'm surprised how often those numbers change variably overnight, depending on who may be working or who may be in charge. So there is a little bit of leeway back and forth, but generally, yes, we're close to where you're at.
I'm at two shops now. As you know, I moved from San Francisco General to down south, and I'm currently at UCLA, Reagan, and at Olive View. is a county hospital north of LA, and they have different requirements at different practice patterns at the two sites. So I don't know. I think it's pretty institution dependent.
One word of caution, and that has to do with the patient population. So he said one of the most common etiologies for this disease is, or this presentation, is pneumonia. So even when we get it right and we make the diagnosis and we get the appropriate treatment, the cycle of inflammation and disease progresses in the initial 24 to 48 hours. And so let's say you hit the sweet spot with a humidified high-flow nasal cannula, the need could escalate in the initial 24 to 48 hours, and that would surprise no one.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I completely agree with that.
Really outstanding comments, John, Peter, Rob. Thanks so much for this analysis. I think this has been really, really incredibly helpful on such a common scenario, a patient presentation that we really encounter every day. And your feedback, your comments about this particular study really provide the nuance that I think we need at the bedside and thinking about these therapies rather than simply casting aside high flow and saying, it doesn't improve mortality. We don't need to use it or implement it. But there are some impactful, I think, patient-centered benefits that Peter, John, Rob, you alluded to that I think are beneficial. And so I would ask all of you, any questions, comments, reflections on the SOHO trial, please shoot us an email so we can continue the conversation outside of the podcast. But we couldn't be more appreciative of you tuning in to listen to our rundown, our analysis and thoughts on the SOHO trial as you move forward, graduating, moving out on your own, or starting residency, progressing through residency, starting fellowship or midway through fellowship and caring for these patients. And really, the nuance is once again, utilizing high flow nasal cannula. That's going to wrap it for this particular podcast. Once again, thanks for joining us. We really look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.